And now, it's Boomer Life, lifestyle discussion designed to make your life more engaging, meaningful, and complete. Celebrating the baby boomer generation, this is Boomer Life on Sea Isle 650.
Welcome to Boomer Life on Sea Isle 650. I'm George Gordon. April is Parkinson's Awareness Month, and today, April 11th, 2016, is World Parkinson's Day. On Boomer Life today, we're talking about the changing perceptions of Parkinson's and how to live well with a diagnosis. Everybody affected by Parkinson's deserves to have the latest tools needed to live the healthiest life possible for as long as possible. At Parkinson's Society, British Columbia, their goal is to provide programs and services specifically designed for people living with the disease. Joining us in the studio today from Parkinson, BC, is CEO Jean Blank. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Now, Jean is an experienced leader in nonprofit, private industry, healthcare, and education. She was the CEO of the Alzheimer's Society, BC, executive director of the Canadian Diabetes Association, Pacific. Prior to these positions, she provided expertise in organizational development, training, leadership to a range of clients and employers in all levels of government and healthcare. Jean, welcome to the show, and tell us a bit about your background and what led you to your role in Parkinson, BC.
I think you've covered my background pretty well there. My experience in nonprofits, in particular around raising awareness and increasing programs and services to people affected by a disease. Parkinson's is unfortunately has a growing incidence in British Columbia, and so it was looking for some additional tools to increase awareness about the disease, and especially reaching out to people affected by the disease, how they could live better by accessing various services and supports and fighting back themselves in terms of exercise issues.
Now, you talk about bringing to your role, you know, I think a role of hope in that a disease that was perhaps even 20 years ago was in the background, not in the limelight, and then, you know, names like Muhammad Ali and Michael J. Fox came to the forefront, and it wasn't just the old person's disease, and it, in fact, covers all ages.
That's right, yeah. I think even as early as early 2000s, there was a very different approach to treating people with Parkinson's disease. It was rest and maybe not even physiotherapy, never mind more active exercise. And so now there's a very different approach. Unfortunately, we also are seeing a younger demographic as well being diagnosed with the disease. So we have people as young as in their 30s. Unfortunately, that one young lady that was in her late 20s that was diagnosed with the disease. So it's still in the smaller numbers that are those that are under 60, but unfortunately we are seeing this, and it's called young onset. So, for example, we have an awareness campaign, April being World Parkinson's Awareness Month. We have an awareness campaign trying to educate people to this disease, that it doesn't discriminate. It does reach across various age groups, across gender, sexual orientation, across race, ethnicities. So we really want people to get that message. We have a transit ad campaign running in Vancouver, Victoria, Kelowna, and Prince George. And people will also see posters set up in community centers, recreation centers, that kind of thing. If I could just take a minute, I'd like to just briefly tell about the five people who've lent their faces to the campaign, just to give an illustration of how it does sweep across those different factors. So, for example, we've got Jim. He's currently age 42. He's a motorcycle enthusiast. He was diagnosed at the age of 33.
Wow.
And he's gone through quite a bit of change. He was one of the folks that it progressed fairly quickly, and so he became a candidate for an intervention called deep brain stimulation, and it has helped him quite incredibly. But he is very active and is able to move and enjoy life and still participate in work, which at age 42, you can imagine, is pretty important. We also have Dan. He's currently 83. At age 80, he decided he was going to cycle across Canada and from the southernmost border to the northernmost accessible road to raise awareness about Parkinson's disease. It took him 3 years because there was a road washout in Inuvik the first time he tried that one. And then he had to move from an upright cycle road bike to a recumbent bike because he had experienced a back issue in the second try. But he made it. He is now 83 years old, and he was diagnosed in 2007.
Started at the age of 80 to do it.
Started at the age of 80. Pretty incredible, man. We have Hope Diamond. She's 51. She's a drag queen. She's in corporate management and entertainment. She was diagnosed in 2013. We have Zell. She's 60 years old. She was diagnosed 6 years ago. She's very active, a skier, a cyclist, an outdoor enthusiast. Unfortunately, she was lost her voice, and she was a business consultant, and so she has did have to retire quite soon after the diagnosis. She's on our board, though, and she's an incredibly bright woman, and she communicates through using texting. We also have Viola. She's 66 now. She was diagnosed in 1993, so she was quite young. She was an IT professional. She has now retired, but she stays involved. She is a fabulous artist, and if you go on our website, you can see a little bit more about all these folks.
Well, that's pretty important information, and the one thing I got through all of this, it didn't matter what age some of these people who are dealing with Parkinson's, it doesn't matter what age they are. They are prepared to do whatever it takes to live their life to the fullest. Even if you're 80 years old and you think you can ride a bicycle from one end of the globe to the other, I think that's pretty amazing. And for people who lose their voice, you talked about the one woman who wasn't able to participate in her business anymore, and I think of Linda Ronstadt, one of those beautiful voices robbed by Parkinson's. I saw an interview with her, and it's heartbreaking, but she is another one that never gave up. Do whatever she can. She's still trying to live her life to the fullest. Do we have a handle on the numbers of people with Parkinson's disease here in BC and in Canada?
So the Ministry of Health numbers for 2012-13 tell us that there are 12,500 British Columbians living with the disease. I just got a proclamation for from the government, BC government, for April Awareness Month, and it says 13,300, so as we would expect, there has been an increase in the numbers. In Canada, we're not as fortunate to have as good data collection in other provinces, so they're still using a 2008 number, which is 100,000 Canadians.
As we had mentioned before, that as the years go on, we have more. We're going to hear from people who are researching this disease and looking for better ways to live as the show goes on. We'll talk to a person who is living with Parkinson's disease and moving on. Is it the greater awareness and the greater amount of research that is allowing us to identify more cases as opposed to, well, there are more and more cases of Parkinson's, or is the incidence increasing?
Well, the incidence is increasing, and it really does depend on the data collection system that your Ministry of Health has in place. So as I said, here in BC, we're fortunate. They have been collecting statistics since 2000, and so that's we were able to track incidence and prevalence actually in most of the larger communities across British Columbia.
I know that one of the myths that we've talked about is that this is an old person's disease. You have pointed out that it hits people of all ages, even as young as in their 20s. With this being April, Parkinson's Awareness Month, is there a big takeaway for listeners about, you know, what they can do to inform themselves better or to help in this fight?
I mean, it's largely that we want people to be aware that it doesn't just affect the senior population, that it does cross all boundaries, it doesn't discriminate, and that you can live, most people can live fairly well if you have access to appropriate medication, care, and if you're able to fight back with exercise.
Do we know what causes it?
Unfortunately, no. We will later in the program have a chance to ask that again of a couple of researchers at the Movement Disorder Clinic. But there is a feeling, well, I shouldn't say feeling, there's increasing evidence to show that it's probably a combination of genetics and environmental influences.
Not to say that it's hereditary, just because perhaps your parents, one of your parents may have had it, doesn't mean that you're naturally, or necessarily, at least we don't understand at this point, that you're going to pass that on through your genes. So there's a tremendous amount of work to be done. One of the programs that you're talking about is the Parkinson's movement and step-by-step, mostly step-by-step. Would you like to talk a little bit about that?
Sure. The Parkinson's movement, first of all, we started last year just to get people more aware of the influence of exercise on their ability to live better. And we did it really as our April awareness campaign, but we've decided that that's something that people should try and do throughout the year. So it's really a year-long campaign. Step-by-step is more or less like your New Year's resolution in January, but happening in April when weather gets better across the province. And it's really a walking program in a group setting. We know that often motivation is a real difficulty for people to get started exercising. So if you have a commitment to a group, it may increase your ability to do this, to get committed to it. And it's based over 12 weeks with the intent that you start with where you're at, and then every week you increase your targets so that you increase your fitness level by the end of the 12 weeks. And we sincerely hope that the groups continue to walk together, but it's a set up so that at least it's a kickstart type of program.
And this is not just for physical betterment. I would think that there's a big psychological lift that you're doing something here.
Yeah. Some of the... Again, you'll have an exercise researcher that can speak to this better than me later on in the program, but there's some thought that the hormones that our body produces when we exercise may temporarily take over the role of dopamine, which is the chemical that's missing in people with Parkinson's disease, or decreased in people in Parkinson's disease. And some of those exercise hormones are the same ones that make us feel good, so there's also an impact on depression and just in general feeling better.
So complicated, so many things to think about and so much more to learn. You can get more information about Parkinson's disease at parkinson.bc.ca. This show will also be available to you on the Seattle 650 website under shows. And we will have a blog there, so you will be able to hear this. If you didn't catch everything that we said, we will have that for you there, and we invite you to join in, and especially don't forget that website again, parkinson.bc.ca. We'll be back on Boomer Life. I'm George Gordon. This is Seattle 650.
Celebrating the Boomer lifestyle. This is Boomer Life on Seattle 650. Back. This is Boomer Life on Seattle 650.
We are back on Boomer Life. I'm George Gordon. You're listening to the beautiful voice of Linda Ronstadt, that voice silenced by Parkinson's disease. And today we're talking about the disease, what we know about it, what we're doing about it for people who must live with this, people with Parkinson's. We are joined in studio by Parkinson Society, British Columbia CEO Jean Blake, and also joining us in studio is neurologist Dr. Silke Cresswell. Welcome.
Thank you.
Dr. Cresswell works at UBC and also at the Pacific Parkinson's Research Center. Can you tell us a bit more about your background and how you end up working in this specialty?
Yeah, so I trained as a neurologist in Germany and then had the good fortune to do a movement disorder fellowship in Queen Square in London. And I was really fascinated by it because it is so complex as a disease. It has the movement aspects which very much appeal to me from a sports background, but it also has a lot of neuropsychiatric and what we call non-motor aspects to it. And it was really very much about the whole person. You also get to know people over time. It's a bit of like being a GP because you really form relationships over the years. And all of that together just appealed to me.
What are some of the early signs and symptoms? I'm sure it could have been mistaken for, especially if it was a younger person, well, somebody's just clumsy or something like that. But there are signs now that you can tell if that person should be tested for Parkinson's.
Yes, absolutely. You're right. And it is very much a clinical diagnosis. So when somebody comes to the clinic, we look for signs of slowness of movement. We look for signs of stiffness in the joints and in the muscles. We look for tremor, so this shaking, particularly at rest. So when somebody is just sitting quietly, maybe watching TV, and then the arm shakes. It is not really the shaking that somebody gets when they lift a cup of coffee, for example. That is often something different. So those are the three kind of core symptoms, and then often more later on in their disease, balance can become a problem as well. But you're absolutely right that in the very beginning, this is all pretty subtle. It all starts really, really subtle and then progresses over time. So somebody might, for example, develop very small handwriting, or they might not swing their arm, or they seem to have a frozen shoulder but not really ever getting better from that. Or I had some athletes telling me, well, you know, I've always been swimming for my whole life, and suddenly I started swimming in circles because one side of the body isn't just doing what it is supposed to do. Or I had a skier who would say, well, you know, I've been skiing for many, many years, and I'm very happy to turn right, but I just cannot get myself to turn left. I have problems with left turn. And that is because it is often asymmetrical. So one side of the body is affected first and more, and then over time, this spreads to the other side, but you would notice symptoms on one side of the body. The other symptoms, such as the voice might get softer, the singing voice might change, and then there are very important non-motor symptoms. And these are often present before somebody develops any problems with movement. And that is something we recognize now much more than we did in the past. And one of them, and that is really that's a very important one, is acting out of dreams in your sleep. So what happens is that when we're dreaming, we should be paralyzed. So if you dream, let's say you're running away from the intruder or you're fighting the lion, what should happen is that you're just lying really quietly in your bed. But with Parkinson's, that switch that would switch your movements off might not work anymore. And that's something kind of really basic in the brain. And you might start acting out what you're dreaming. So you might indeed start to run seemingly in your bed. You might even fall out of bed. You might punch your bed partner because you're trying to fight with a lion. And that can happen years, if not decades. So there are some cases described as 5 decades before anybody develops anything else. And then other symptoms could be a loss of sense of smell. I mean, there are many reasons, of course, why people could lose their sense of smell. But nearly every patient, every person with Parkinson's would have reduced sense of smell. Constipation, depression, anxiety that come on more in midlife, later life, they can all be foreboders and early symptoms of Parkinson's.
Well, now, Jean has already told us that this disease can affect all ages, all sexual orientation, so does it seem to affect men and or men and women the same in the same way or in the same numbers?
Nearly. So it's about 60% men and 40% women if you look at large populations. But I absolutely echo what Jean already said, that it is very much across the populations. Age, for sure, is the biggest risk factor, and I think that is very important to recognize as we are all getting older and we have an aging population. So this will be a condition that we'll see more and more of, and Jean already mentioned the numbers for British Columbia alone, where we actually got pretty good numbers.
And almost 13,000.
And the important bit about that number is that it actually changed. So looking at numbers from the Ministry of Health in 2011-2012, in the 10 years prior leading up to that time, the number of Parkinson's patients or number of people living with Parkinson's had actually grown by 40%.
Wow.
And you can just extrapolate
40%,
40%, yes.
And our boomer generation is aging by the day. So, and forgive me if this is not the appropriate terminology for describing Parkinson's, but so many other diseases become, we learn about it, we learn about the growth in the population, and they become the cause du jour, but Parkinson's disease has not been what we might call sexy in terms of getting the attention that it should. Is it is it gaining that status now? Or are we beginning to understand? We just talked about the numbers and the growth in it. You're doing work on it. We're going to be talking to other researchers. We're going to talk to a person who is dealing with Parkinson's. Is the awareness breaking through?
I hope so. And I think Michael J. Fox, for example, has really done a lot for the face of this condition and raising awareness and to really motivating people to be active about it. I think the sense of kind of resignation is waning, and we have many more new research avenues that we're following. The disease was first described nearly 200 years ago, so next year's anniversary. And I would say that I've been doing this now for nearly 15 years, and I've certainly seen a lot of change during that time, let alone. And it's certainly also due to, thanks due to the Parkinson Society in BC, that we get more and more awareness here.
Tell me one thing that frustrates you the most in trying to get to the bottom, to defeat this disease. And tell me something that has happened that has driven you even harder to find a cure for this.
But I think that what is happening is, of course, in the clinic, every time I'm in the clinic, and I meet so many people who are dealing with this every day, and many of them are just plain inspirational, and they're very creative in dealing with it, very determined. And that in itself, how could you sit back and, you just have to do what you can do. I think the problems we have in understanding what is going on, because we still don't quite know what causes Parkinson's, it's really the Nobel Prize question, is that it probably isn't just one Parkinson's. It probably is several conditions that look very similar and that will have the same symptoms, and when you look at the brain under the microscope, you'll see the same changes. But the factors leading to it are probably different, either entirely different in that it's maybe more genetic for one person, and about 1% of people living with Parkinson's have purely genetic forms of Parkinson's, but the vast majority will not have a purely genetic form. They will have a combination or maybe even a purely environmental form. So trying to tease apart how we can group these different Parkinson's diseases that make up Parkinson's disease to then get to the bottom of each one of them, that is a challenge. Another challenge is that, at least so for the longest time, we could only make the diagnosis when somebody already had motor problems. And as I said earlier, these motor problems come actually a few years after something has been going on. So the sleep difficulties, the depression, the anxiety, the constipation, the difference in your sense of smell, all of that comes many years beforehand often. And we really need to catch it early, because by the time that the motor symptoms come along, the majority of the cells that produce dopamine, this messenger in the brain that is being reduced, have already vanished. So we're a bit late in really applying therapies that could reverse what is going on. And so what is happening now is that we are really branching out much more. We're looking at the gut, for example. Could this disease start in the gut because constipation, or maybe in the nose because your reduced sense of smell is early present? Could that be something that comes in from the environment? Could that be something, and that is something really on vogue right now, be related to all the bacteria and organisms and viruses that we all have and need to have living in our intestines, which is called the microbiome?
Mm-hmm.
With that, we're looking at the immune system as well. We're looking at inflammation and how that might play a role, how that interacts with the brain. So there are many new avenues that we're following now. Of course, the genetic insights that let us understand better if certain genes can cause Parkinson's, what is the function of the genes in the cells, and going from there, we can then better understand what happens in the cell. So we think that, for example, proteins that are in the cell aren't being processed properly. They kind of build up, and then the soil junk that is building up kind of clogs up the cell. The cell can't work anymore. energy production seems to be affected. So from genetics, we will understand a lot of what is going on at the cell level, and then we have new imaging methods where we can look at networks in the brain, how are different parts of the brain talking to each other, how are they communicating, how is the brain trying to also compensate for what is happening.
Wow. So it sounds like we've come so far and yet we have so far to go to beat this disease. Let's turn our attention back to Jean Blake, Parkinson's Society, BC CEO. Jean, let's talk about the Parkinson's disease that affects the loved ones, the people who must care for those who are dealing with this dreadful disease. They're kind of lost in this picture many times.
Early to mid-stage, the care partner, the family member, just sees themselves as they're there to support the person, and they don't see that there's a huge impact on their lives, other than obviously if you've now got a chronic disease with your loved one, it does change how you look at the future. However, as the disease progresses, there's increasing need for a care partner to start moving into more of a caregiving role, and that's where we see that the impact on the spouse, the adult child, the family can increase quite a bit. And so we also are looking to how we can support those folks. We have 50 support groups led across British Columbia by wonderful volunteers. A few of them are focused specifically on those caregiving needs, and so we do work to support them with what their particular issues are. And a lot of it is education and information about the healthcare system, advocating for their loved one, navigating the system, and also making sure they stay healthy. We have just recently started to engage in more education for those folks, and so we ran a webinar for them last fall. It was greatly attended, and some people are living in fairly remote locations where there wouldn't be the numbers to have just a separate care partner support group. So we're looking at offering that by webinar this coming fall. And similarly, young onset, I talked about how we're seeing that in a younger and younger age group. Fortunately, is still in the smaller percentages of those folks, but it does make it difficult then when we're trying to address issues that are more specific to still trying to work, having young children at home. And so, again, we reached out to a wonderful technology and ran a series of webinars, which Silky led one of the sessions for us. And the feedback after the sessions were over was they would really like to continue to meet as an online support group. So we're going to as well put that in place for the fall.
Still to come, we'll be talking with some more of the people who are working in the research end of beating Parkinson's disease. We'll talk to one of those who is coping with it and making sure his life is being led to the fullest. And we hope that you'll stay with us. You're listening to Boomer Life. I'm George Gordon. And if you'd like more information about what we're talking about today, you can go to parkinson.bc.ca or check the CL650 website under shows, under talk, and the blog will be there. I'm George Gordon.
Celebrating the Boomer lifestyle. This is Boomer Life on CL650. We're back. This is Boomer Life on CL650.
We can work it out. We can work it out.
We are back, and this is Boomer Life. I'm George Gordon. Today, we're talking about the changing perceptions and living well with Parkinson's disease with the Parkinson's Society, British Columbia CEO Jean Blake. Also joining us, neurologist Dr. Sophie Cresswell, and UBC researcher and PhD candidate at Sakelly, and Richard Mayaday, a person with Parkinson's, what we call a PWP. That's what you're called. We'd like to welcome you, Richard,
sure,
for joining us and sharing your story. You are described as a filmmaker, digital designer, brainstormer, positive doer. Tell me, what were the first signs of Parkinson's disease that you noticed?
Well, initially affected my left side, which is my dominant side. And what actually, it was a friend that noticed it first for me, and I kind of ignored her, as typically men do when women tell them what's going wrong. But thanks to her, like, really pushing me to get a check by a doctor, that I finally saw my family doctor, and after several visits with him, finally saw a neurologist, and making a long story short, I was diagnosed with Parkinson's. But because I was only 37 at the time, that neurologist suggested that I go to UBC, to the Parkinson's Institute, and get a second opinion. And sure enough, my current doctor, Dr. McEwen, confirmed the initial neurologist diagnosis. And so again, for me, it wasn't so much of a shock. I was kind of preparing myself for it. Like, I thought, well, the best case out of all the potential things that it could be was that, well, if it's going to be anything, it's probably best that it's Parkinson's. And so I kind of prepared myself for that.
What was the gut reaction, though, when they told you?
Well, honestly, only for like a brief millisecond, I was really shocked and disappointed, right? But because of the fact that I was brought up to be very positive, and that really, the fact that that I had this illness now, is just, for me, from that point forward, I just said I have to make the most out of it and be a source of positive encouragement.
That's an interesting point we often hear when people are dealing with any disease or condition. You have to keep a positive attitude. Well, it's always easy until it's you, but
yeah.
But you have exemplified, you've got a great sense of humor, and you're also using Twitter to talk about some of the situations,
yeah.
Like some of the frustrations. How would you like to share some of those with us?
Well, it's only recently that some of the frustrations have really started to take a hold, and so the fact that I'm tripping up at times and some shuffling, it's been a source of frustration because of the fact that I used to be a sprinter back in my university days, right? So having been someone who ran fast, now being slowed down, it's been a bit of an ego crush. But again, I have friends that have been really encouraging. They just tell me, you're getting older. That's all that's happening.
Yeah. Well, you've talked about some of the changes that you're going through, and you're cognizant of what's going on. What are some of the good things that you found about dealing with the disease? Exercise?
Definitely exercise. The fact that I participated in a study, and for me, just the fact that riding my bike, running, playing sports, like staying as physically active as possible has really helped me in terms of like just overall good feeling. And that, I think, goes without saying, regardless of whatever illness or condition, I think exercise is really key to long-term health.
Right. I noticed that you use walking canes. We see a lot of people use, and for striding, it gives you better balances. Has that made a huge difference? I mean, were you ever told that, well, you know what, you should maybe not try and walk, or were you always, the people that were helping you, were they always encouraging you to get out and stay more active?
Well, it is something that has always been part of me, that I want to take control of this rather than it taking control of me. So the walking sticks really do help me, because it kind of motivates me to keep my arms moving forward, because they tend to stay still, right? So it's something that I have to be cognizant of, and keeping my momentum moving forward. So that's why I'm using the walking
mm-hmm.
sticks.
I see, you know what, I see more people with, not people, just people with Parkinson's that are of all walks of life using them. What a great tool they've become. Now you are also a digital designer, you're a filmmaker. Are you still able to work with your passions in what you do in work life?
Very, very much so. What I found that's quite interesting, that because after I've found out that I have Parkinson's, one of the, I think, the side effects has been that I've become much more creative. And so it's kind of a weird thing, but I just found that my creative output's just skyrocketed since. So it's been a benefit, actually.
Does that mean you focus more, or is it just you don't? Is it the psychological? Well, that's a second thought. Or, no, that's an idea. Let's run with it.
Yeah. So it's something that's really I found that my writing has become much more something that I've
the colors come
out,
right?
Yeah, exactly.
Excellent, excellent. How has Parkinson's Society BC helped you?
Well, how it initially helped me was at the very beginning. I participated in for a conference for newly diagnosed patients, and that really helped me get an idea of what it is that I'm facing. And having heard a couple of people talk from their experience of having Parkinson's, that helped me to see what it is that I'm going to be dealing with. And so that's the initial help that I got from BC Parkinson's.
Well, you sound like the role model for positivity and that making a difference in your life. If you had one thing to tell somebody who was just diagnosed with this, what would you say to them?
I would say that it's not as bad as one may think it's going to be. But when I first got it, I thought, well, it's going to be really rough after 10 years, right? But this is 11 years now into my illness, and I'm still doing quite well considering. So I think that maintaining a positive attitude is really key to battling this illness.
Excellent. Yep. Richard, thank you. Dr. Kressel, maybe we could go back to you for just a bit. And we've talked a bit about now the exercises that can be done, but the positive effects, I don't think, can be downplayed. It's not just incidental.
No, not at all. And in the clinic, I see this really every day, exactly as you describe it. The people who take exercise seriously, I often say, you know, exercise is your new job. The people who take exercise seriously do so much better, in a short term as well as in the long term. And I think Matt will speak to that, to what the underlying mechanisms are, what we think the underlying mechanisms are, since they're only just being figured out. It certainly is positive on many different levels. There's the physical aspect of it, just the fitness aspect, because we know, of course, it has positive effects on the heart, on the muscles, weight, on bones, and all these things. But I'm sure it is psychological. In one of the studies that you actually participated in, that you ran and that we did together, people after one single bout of exercise actually had better mood for the rest of the day, and they were also moving better. And I'm sure Matt will talk about that. So it has the kind of mechanism that influences your mood and makes it better, but it's also something you can do. It is something where you have control and where you are active, rather than sitting back passively and being fed something, you know, the medication, but you take control. And that is really also what we do with the medication. With the medication, we try to enable this level of activity. This is exercise, and it's varied exercise, so anything from aerobics, so getting your heart rate up, getting somebody to break out in a sweat, as well as balance, stretching, strengthening exercises. But also activity on the social level and on the cognitive level. So exactly, you're just exemplifying that. So everything you've just described, you want people to be out there. We want people to mix with others, to keep going with their activities and interests. And that, I think, is really what keeps people well. And that makes it possible to live well with this condition. Now, there are some people where this is more challenging than for others, just because, as I said, it is a very individual disease, so it'll affect people differently and with different degrees of severity. But if I look across the clinic, the people who exercise do just hands down better. Of all the things I would recommend, this is, you know, obviously you need the medication on board, but exercise is really the pillar to live well with it.
Terrific. All right, then let's stay on that thought, and we bring in researcher and PhD candidate at Sekeli, who is doing current research on exercise and Parkinson's disease. What are you finding? What are the connections that you found in beating this disease, if we can?
Yeah, thanks very much for having me on the show, George. Exercise is a phenomenal treatment that we can use for exercise. The thing about that we see in the research is that it works, and we know it works, but no one understands why it works. So we're trying to understand the mechanisms that undermine exercise so we can get at better therapeutic avenues for Parkinson's disease. So the study that Richard participated in, the one that Dr. Creswell alluded to, we were trying to look at the electrical activity of the brain and compare it to electrical activity of the muscles. And what we did is we took a group of people who had Parkinson's disease and we took a group of people who didn't have Parkinson's disease and we put them on a bike and we had them exercise and cycle at different intensities. We wanted to see if there's any similarities in brain activity, muscle activity, or differences between these two groups. The first interesting thing that we found was that after a single bout, so just 15 minutes of exercise, the people with Parkinson's felt better, they had better movement, they had better cognition, so they overall felt better, and this was after a simple 15-minute bike ride. The interesting thing from the neurological perspective that is that we actually saw a different brain pattern that was activated in people with Parkinson's disease. And we saw this despite similar muscle activity. So we think it could be potentially a compensatory mechanism that's occurring, but we still need to do some more research within this. So that was kind of our first initial finding, just looking at one single bout of exercise, what can actually change the brain and how can it actually help people with Parkinson's.
I understand there's all kinds of studies being done now that what you're working on, the 14 studies on just on treadmill training alone. What are you finding? I mean, that's fairly simple, I guess, that you can hang on and you can set your pace and so on. But again, it seems to be you get in with the good air, out with the bad air, and it seems oversimplified, but it does make that much of a difference.
Absolutely, yeah. And it's funny, when you look at exercise treatments in the literature, there's such a wide range of different therapies that claim to be beneficial. You know, one end of the spectrum, you have treadmill training or aerobic training. You have work by Dr. Jay Alberts down the Cleveland Clinic that's called forced exercise, and that's where they actually put someone on a tandem bike, so we'll have a person with Parkinson's on the back, and they'll have an elite cyclist on the front, and the person on the front will just be going as hard as they can, and the person on the back, the person with Parkinson's, is just kind of along for the ride, and they're forced to go a specific speed, and that claims to be beneficial. But then there's also one of the largest randomized control trials published in the New England Journal of Medicine was Tai Chi and Parkinson's. And they compared that to resistance training, they actually showed that Tai Chi was better for balance. And so you have two opposite ends of the spectrum. You have very high intensity and very low, more balanced base, and both of them seem to have benefit. So what we're trying to understand is, actually, instead of trying to identify the specific type or intensity that we should be exercising, if we can understand the mechanism, the changes in the brain, for example, then I think we can better understand what exercises we should actually be targeting.
How's the funding for all this research coming along? Or is that like dropping the grenade into the middle of the conversation, you know? Silky?
It's always a challenge. So there are funding bodies run by the government, the Canadian Health Research Institute, and getting funding is definitely a challenge. And as a researcher, you have to keep applying for funding on a very regular basis. And of course, jobs from people on a team depend on that. If you can't get a grant, even if it isn't funded, and only a small minority of grants are being funded, then that has implications for your whole center and for your operations. That often makes it difficult to really plan well ahead. You know, you really have to often plan project by project. The Parkinson Society is fortunately also engaged in supporting research, so that has been very helpful, and that is very good. Fortunately, at the Pacific Parkinson's Research Center, we also have a very active group of individuals, the Pacific Parkinson's Research Institute, who support research endeavors at our particular institution. That has been extremely helpful to also get pilot projects off the ground and to support a lot of the infrastructure that you just don't get grant funding for, but that you have to have in place in order to then run quite a few projects. We have one exercise project, and I'm sure Matt is going to talk about that, because this is a really big one, headed by Dr. John Searle, that was also funded by a private individual who is very interested in Parkinson's and exercise. So it's a mix, but it's always a struggle, and it's something that certainly keeps us on our toes as researchers, and we always hope it would be better and more predictable, and yeah.
I'm fortunate enough that my 2 years of my research is funded by the Parkinson's Society Canada, so I was given a research grant as a graduate student, so I'm very fortunate for that. And then the project specifically that I'm working on was funded by one individual who was very interested in exercise and Parkinson's, and that came through the Pacific Parkinson's Research Institute. So without funding like that, there would be it'd be very difficult to do the research that we're doing. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Something that both of you have talked about in understanding, getting down to the cell level of what might cause this disease and what might take it in a particular direction. So stem cell research, is that going to play a role in perhaps finding a cure for that, or is that seemingly the answer to everything, although it hasn't been yet?
Yeah, so there was a lot of hype around it, and I think we've learned a lot from those studies. Unfortunately, they are not at treatments that involve stem cells are certainly not at a point where we can use it in the clinic. There are still quite a few problems, including that Parkinson's isn't just affecting one cell population in the brain, but it really affects the brain more or less in its entirety. So you can't, unless you can regrow and reroute the whole brain, a single population of stem cells will only ever deal with one particular area of the problem. Then the stem cells also need to connect to the right centers, and what we've also seen is that some of those cells that were being implanted, now these are cells, fetal cells, so really brand new cells, that should not have any of the protein that is clogging up cells and Parkinson's in them. And for some individuals who had received those stem cells, when they had died and they looked at the brain under the microscope, they saw these changes, these proteins that build up in Parkinson's, even in the new cells. So there is a hypothesis out there that what we call the prion hypothesis, where these protein accumulations seem to go from cell to cell to cell, and therefore even if you put new cells in, they might then be infected, affected by this protein accumulation. So although we've learned a lot from stem cells, there are also still many obstacles that will need to be overcome, and I don't think it's going to be something in the near future that would be in the clinical realm. Unfortunately, we have quite a few people who see on the internet, you know, there are stem cell therapies in Mexico and China and Germany and Poland and the US and various places that offer those for a lot of money, and people go there to get this treatment. And it is really not something that we as clinicians or researchers would recommend at this point at all.
Well, I guess if we're going to sum it up to this point, we don't know what causes it. We don't know what's going to cure it, but we sure are becoming much more aware of Parkinson's disease, how it can be treated, how people like Richard are using their positive way of thinking to take everything that's within their power to make their life full, meaningful, and not to be held back by this. Coming up, we're going to talk to some folks who have understood that song can help in more ways than one, and we'll talk about some of the problems that people who are dealing with Parkinson's must do in trying to cover all their costs. That's coming up on Boomer Life here on CIAL 650.
Celebrating the business boomer lifestyle, this is Boomer Life on CIAL 650. Back. This is Boomer Life on CIAL 650.
Living in the morning, living my life.
We are back on Boomer Life. I'm George Gordon, and today we're talking about Parkinson's disease, changing the perceptions about it, and living well with this condition. We have been hearing from the experts who are researching this. We've been talking to the folks with Parkinson BC about the work that they're doing. Now, I kind of steered the questions a little bit off, and I didn't give a chance to give our PhD candidate and researcher, Matt Kelly, a chance to talk about the study that you're actually doing on the disease. Tell us more.
Yeah, so what we're, as I said earlier, we're really trying to get at the mechanism, and we're quite fortunate at UBC to have a program with the physics department called TRIOMPH. And TRIOMPH is a cyclotron that we're able to make radioactive material, and with that we can do an imaging technique called PET, or positron emission tomography. And what that allows us to study is specific cellular behavior in the brain of active living people. So what we're doing with Parkinson's disease, we know dopamine is an important neurochemical or neurotransmitter in the brain, and we can study the behavior of dopamine within people who are alive. So we're looking at how exercise might affect dopamine release, for example, is one way, and we can look at that with our imaging, and we're also looking at how exercise might affect neuroinflammation. So there's a theory within the disease that there might be an initial inflammatory response of the cellular level that occurs in the brain when people get diagnosed or even prior to diagnosis. And as this inflammation becomes chronic over time, it actually might contribute to the progression of Parkinson's. And what we're trying to look at is to see if exercise actually decreases the amount of this inflammatory response, which would actually be beneficial, and that might be one of the mechanisms that is actually contributing to the therapeutic approach of using exercise for Parkinson's disease.
Fantastic work. Continued success. As we said, with Parkinson's, we don't know what causes it. We don't know what's going to cure it, but we sure are doing a lot more about learning how to deal with it. Your research and Silke Cresswell's going to be so important. Continued success.
Thank you very much.
All right. Now, we're going to talk to Ruthanna Metzger, who has been so busy working with something that seems so simple, but is proving to be, as much as exercise in some individuals, in some cases, so important in dealing with Parkinson's. Ruthanna, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
All right.
Nice to be here.
Tell us about Songshine Program.
The Songshine Program is kind of an all-encompassing program. We started initially with vocalese, which are classical singing exercises. I have a doctorate in voice performance, and my focus as a university teacher was to always build good vocal technique. And then because I had worked with speech therapists and otolaryngologists in a type of consortium comparing our work, I began to wonder if the use of classical singing exercises could strengthen a Parkinson's patient's voice. And at the invitation of Eisenhower Medical Center down here in Southern California, they asked if I would set up a class, and so we did a pilot study. And we had phenomenal success. We discovered that those simple exercises then combined with singing music that was well known, even music that they didn't know at all, really had a profound effect. And the reason it did was because breath flow is essential for freeing the voice. And then the Songshine program expanded. I added a partner, a gentleman who had trained at Juilliard in Shakespeare in the drama division. And, of course, his emphasis in Shakespeare was diction, articulation, the use of the tongue, facial muscles, the lips. And we put that together with role-playing and what we call creative drama and emotional engagement. And we discovered that Parkinson's patients that were perhaps afraid to sing or didn't have any connection to music could also be brought out, the voice could be brought out through playing a role or assuming an identity other than their own. Something like drama therapy, I suppose.
Well, that's amazing because that has worked with people who have stuttering issues. That is one of the treatments or the therapies that have been used. Have you got a couple of stories that you could share with us from people where it's made a big difference in their life?
Oh, I certainly have. Let's talk about Dr. Wayne Curtis. Wayne came to our class because his partner forced him to. He was a clinical psychologist, and when he retired, he had planned to spend his retirement years singing. He sang at a highly professional level, working his way through Columbia University as he was getting his PhD. And then the last year of his practice, he began to see these incredible signs that he knew were probably pointing towards Parkinson's. And so he became a recluse. And then he was brought by his partner to our class, and within less than a month, Wayne was singing again. He made a beautiful CD that he donated to the foundation, and he was out doing karaoke, singing concerts, and his life was literally transformed. Literally transformed, because it reconnected him with something that he had a passion for. I had another gentleman by the name of Harry. Harry came through the door, and I was embarrassed. I couldn't understand a thing Harry said. He had Parkinson's with a very weak voice, very stuttery. Harry had been an accountant. He didn't have a music background. He started singing the vocalies and the songs, and within 2 weeks, Harry was very loud. I mean, you could hear him carry on a conversation, talk on the phone, and it all goes back to the fact that when we sing, more parts, more areas of the brain light up than any other thing that we do. It's amazing. And then, as I said, when you engage them at an emotional level, it's astounding. Those are two. I can give you a lot more.
Well, it's amazing sometimes the simplest things that you discover that can help you deal with a critical issue. And obviously you're giving hope. You're making people feel better about themselves. You are giving them a sense that they can fight with this disease with a degree of success day after day. Continued success with your work, and we hope to hear more from you and Songshine in the years to come.
And we're looking forward to doing a training at up in Vancouver coming May 12th through 14th, and we'll be training instructors or teachers to use these methods to really empower the voice. It's all about freeing and empowering the voice and stimulating the brain.
Wonderful. Okay, give me the dates again and where this is going to be.
It's May 12th through 14th, and all of the information is available on the website for Parkinson's Society, British Columbia. We're waitlisted right now, but if there is someone out there who's interested in exploring these methods, they should get in touch with PSBC, and you never know. We may have to come up a second time.
I think you would be welcome. Thanks, Ruth Anna.
Now, thank you.
Now,
have a great day.
You too. You too.
Bye-bye.
Now joining us, Sherry Zelazny. I got that right?
Yes.
M.A., RSLP, clinical speech language pathologist with extensive experience in evaluation and treatment of voice disorders. One of the things that you have made me aware of is the problem for people with Parkinson's in communication and swallowing difficulties and how to improve their situation. Tell us a bit about what you're finding your work in that area.
Sure. Well, we know that 90 to 100% of people with Parkinson's are going to experience voice and swallowing problems. It's not the same for everybody. It doesn't take necessarily a progression as the disease progresses. So you can have minor issues that maybe you can deal with, or you can have major issues anywhere along the road of Parkinson's. For voice, you've mentioned some things. The primary symptom that we see in people with Parkinson's with voice is a low vocal volume, so people get softer and softer and softer. The quality of voice can be impaired, so people might be a little bit hoarse, perhaps. It might be effortful to talk. And there can be tremor. So all the things that you've talked about today already, rigidity, tremor, stiffness, those things can affect the communication and swallow mechanism, and in turn that affects voice and the actual ability to swallow. So some of the symptoms for swallowing, and these don't always correspond, voice and swallow together, even though it's the same mechanism. And when I say that, I mean the larynx and the vocal folds and the mouth and lips and teeth and tongue and everything that we use to communicate and swallow. Regarding swallowing, there may be drooling. There could be coughing and choking, of course, is one of the primary things that we are concerned about. And that's quite obvious, but some of the other things that I try to help people with Parkinson's understand is that even if it's taking you longer to eat your meal, you may be having some trouble chewing, swallowing, managing food. If you have stopped eating certain items, you might want to think about why you've stopped eating them.
And maybe it's because they're more difficult to handle and difficult to push down. And that all has implications to nutrition and health and your ability to exercise and how you feel every day. So everything is of course connected. It's a disease that affects the entire body. And when we talk about helping people with voice and swallowing, we talk about improving and maintaining quality of life. So there's very, very effective treatment, especially for voice. The Lee Silverman voice treatment is evidence-based practice. It's the gold standard for treating voice disorders and Parkinson's. And there's very effective both compensatory and rehabilitative or exercise for swallowing, for improving the strength of the muscles. For swallowing. So there's a lot that we can do, and really as a speech pathologist working in this community, my goal is to help people to continue to talk and continue to eat so that they can be healthy and have good quality of life.
So you can have, you can feed yourself physically, but you can also feed the soul, because if you can communicate, you're still in touch, you're still there.
Well, yeah, right, and that's so important. I mean, we're all here communicating, we're communicating with the public through this media, but communication, the ability to talk to somebody, to tell your family that you love them, to continue working, even, you know, going to the movies with a friend, if you're not able to communicate in those settings, then you start to remove yourself from those settings and you don't feel as good about being a part of society and knowing that you have something to contribute through communication. And the same with swallowing. We are quite rewarded by sitting down to eat with people. And if you find, you know, if every Thursday morning you go for coffee and a snack and you can't manage that anymore, or you're drooling, or you spill your cup, or then you take yourself out of that environment and your quality of life changes.
And your mental wellness starts to suffer.
Right.
And your ability then to want to continue to
fight
is impaired.
And the good news is we can do something to help people. There's very, very strong evidence for all the therapies and exercises that we provide. And people would access that through a registered speech language pathologist.
Now, this is all good news, and I guess the question has to be asked, because you're talking about programs, you're talking about treatments, which cost money. Is any of this covered by MSP?
So, generally, occupational therapy, physiotherapy, speech-language pathology are not covered services by MSP. So, something you would think of as going to an outpatient setting, to the hospital, to have outpatient services, unless there's a particular program provided in that facility, it's not going to be covered. If people have extended benefits and they have coverage for speech therapy, then our services are covered, but there's nowhere near enough coverage with extended benefits to take advantage of the therapy that's needed that we know works for people. So one thing we've done with Parkinson's Society British Columbia is we've created a communication and swallow workshop that we take around the province several times a year, and our goal is to help people learn more about communication and swallowing issues with Parkinson's, know how to talk to their physicians about it so that they can advocate for themselves for the services that they need, and start with some exercise. And exercise has been a theme today, and because we communicate and swallow with muscles, then exercise is important there as well. So we're trying to get out to the public, let them know what services are out there, who they need to contact, and that we can help. We can absolutely help.
Well, and this is very important, not just for the person who's fighting Parkinson's, but their caregivers, mm-hmm. loved ones, often the spouse, who goes through as much trauma in trying to, you know, sometimes a helpless feeling, and this is an avenue to where they can be the coach, as it were.
Yeah, and when we do the voice exercises, either in speech therapy or at the communication and swallow workshops, the spouses, their faces light up because they hear their loved one's voice again. And that is a big emotional comfort for us, to hear voices that we are familiar with and hear somebody say, "I love you," again,
wow.
You know, when they haven't been able to say that because their voice is too soft or they don't have the power behind it.
Have you seen some some examples of a life turnaround?
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, absolutely. When I'm able to provide the Lee Silverman voice treatment, that is absolutely, I have people say to me, I never would have stopped working if I knew about this therapy. Or I'm going back to my Thursday morning coffee, or I'm reading to my grandchildren.
I think that's you talk about that one, the spiritual uplift, but also being able to continue working is important. Mm-hmm. As you say, some of these services are not paid for by MSP or perhaps an extended benefits plan. You need some cash, right?
Right.
To put it bluntly.
Right.
And also being able to go to work is also important for the feeling of self-worth.
Yeah. Well, I do always say that I'm happy to help people be a taxpayer again.
Well, it is a cruel, cruel disease. The research that is being done, it's so rewarding to hear about this and the treatments. What numbers, what kind of, how big are your classes when you're working? What numbers are you working with?
Well, the communication and swallow workshops, we do
up to 40, sometimes a little bit more.
Yeah, so we do 6 or 7 a year, and we accept 40 or 50 people into the workshop. We haven't gone beyond that because I like it to be interactive, and we want caregivers to be there and really help people understand how they can be better. And they fill up.
Mm-hmm.
They fill up, and we've gone back to places where we've been before. People are happy to have the information, but also quite frustrated that nobody's ever told them about it before.
I think that we could probably continue talking for another hour about this. It's phenomenal what we're learning about Parkinson's disease. This is Parkinson's Awareness Month. We've been talking to some of the people who are on the front line of raising awareness, raising funds, the researchers who are trying to make the connections in this and how to beat this disease that has no known cause, no known cure, but it certainly can be dealt with, and that lives can be made better, and that you can cope with this. And if you have the right kind of help and treatment, you can live a full life. Now, we can get more information. If you missed any of the part of this program, it will be on podcast, okay, under talk, if you go to CIAL 650. Parkinson.bc.ca. I almost got through the whole show and got it right. CEO of Parkinson Society BC is Gene Blake, who has guided us through this today. Thank you so much for bringing this to our attention and bringing in this wonderful group of people to talk about it.
Thank you, Gordon. It was a wonderful opportunity. And besides the website, let the listeners know that we have a wonderful toll-free information and referral line. And if you're outside of the Vancouver number, it's 1-800-668-3330. And our staff are happy to provide information, educational pieces. We do counseling. We do consultations. So if you need more information, please have a look there and or, of course, our website. We do also really rely on just individual donations to run all of our programs and services. So we have our major fundraiser coming up, not till September, but mark it in your calendar for September 10th or 11th, depending on your community. There are 22 walks in various communities across British Columbia.
Well, the 13,000 people who are dealing with Parkinson's disease here in BC alone, appreciative, I'm sure, of the work that you are doing and everybody else that we talked to today. Thank you so much. This is Boomer Life on CIAL 650.